Well, greetings again, friends and brethren. I hope this finds everyone doing well. It's been a month or so since I've recorded a sermon, so I've had several things in my mind, so I thought I'd just try to address several things here today at once, if I have the time, and hopefully during the process of it, they'll somehow all tie in together. First thing I'd like to do is just a quick review of the upcoming Fall Holy Days. Feast of Trumpets is on September 30th, and the Day of Atonement is on October 9th, and of course the Feast of Tabernacles is the October 14th through 20th, followed immediately by the Last Great Day on October 21st. And even though the Feast of Tabernacles officially kicks off on the 14th, it really starts the evening before, the 13th. And so for those of you attending with us, we need to try to be at the feast site on that Monday of the 13th, because we have services that evening, and that is holy time. It begins at sunset. That's a holy day. So we have a relatively short opening service, probably hour and a half, maybe a little less than 2 hours, on the evening of the 13th, and right around 7:30 or shortly after sunset. And for those of you attending with us in Panama City Beach, Florida, anyway. But again, just as by way of reminder, I know we're all excited about the Feast of Tabernacles, but we should not overlook the two holy days coming up before then, and that's the Feast of Trumpets and the Feast of Atonement. And I won't spend a lot of time on that. I'm just going to briefly read a couple of statements that Mr. Armstrong said about these days as an overview. But if you want to, especially for you that are prospective members that are going to be attending, but also as a review for all of us old timers, so to speak, if you want a good review on the Feast of Trumpets, you can go to the old 58 lesson correspondence course and look at lesson 36. That covers the Feast of Trumpets rather extensively. And lesson 37, when you have time, covers the Day of Atonement. And these are both very, very important days, feast days, brethren. They're very important in the plan of God, what they represent for not only us, but for all of mankind eventually. And then lesson 38 covers the Feast of Tabernacles, and then lesson 39, the Last Great Day. So really, lessons 36 through 39 cover these last four fall holy days, Trumpets, Atonement, Feast of Tabernacles, and the Last Great Day. And I would highly recommend going through those one at a time, and take your time and digest it and study it with your Bible, and it really gives you a broader and deeper spiritual understanding of what these days represent and why we keep them. We keep them primarily because, first and foremost, God commands it. And that's something I just want to touch on. It just came to mind regarding these holy days and the Feast of Tabernacles. Those are commanded holy days. They're not an optional thing that we can do if we choose to, or if we have time, or whatever. God commands those for all mankind, especially for the household of God, and they're really commanded for all mankind, but the majority of mankind just simply is not aware of that command as yet, but they will be. They will be at some time in the future. So, you know, occasionally I hear someone that says, to the effect, well, I'd love to be there at the feast, but just can't make it this year. Well, we need to look into what God's Word says about that, because it's a command. It's a commanded assembly. And, the Feast of Tabernacles, as well as the Sabbath and the Holy Days, are all commanded assemblies. Now, there are extenuating circumstances that prevent someone from making it, such as medical or physical conditions, if you can't physically make it. And in some cases, for prospective members who've not understood or begun saving their second tithe yet, which is what the purpose of that is for, the second tithe, is to be set aside for your use at the holy days, including the Feast of Tabernacles. It pays your way. And so we have to remember that second tithe is holy, just as the first tithe and the third tithe is. Those tithes, we have to always remember, don't belong to us, brethren. They belong to God. And even though you may set that second tithe aside in a savings account or a separate checking account to save it for the feast, We should never touch that for anything, strictly for use on the holy days, even though it's used for you on those days. But it's a command of God to set that aside. So that money that's in there that you have set aside for second tithe, it is holy. That's holy money that belongs to God. All things belong to God, the whole earth. And he just lets us borrow it. So that first tithe, of course, is holy. But then again, so is that second tithe. You know, sometimes we have a tendency to try to tap into that. I know whenever I was first baptized, or even before then, back in when I was single, I had done that at one time. Used some second tithe for something that had nothing to do with the holy days, and I learned a hard lesson. That was around 30 years ago, but it was a hard lesson learned. And I just wanted to convey that on to all of you, and especially the prospective members that are coming along with us. And also the question had come up recently through some of you, especially the newer members or prospective ones that haven't been baptized yet. When do I begin to tithe? Well, you don't wait till you're baptized to begin to tithe. You begin as soon as you're aware of that law. It is a law. I'll touch on that later on in this message, if I have time. But it is a law of God. It's part of keeping that spiritual law of God's commandments. But tithing is, as Mr. Armstrong made it very clear, it is a law, L-A-W, of God. Tithing is. That includes the first tithe, second tithe, and the third tithe. So hopefully, if time permits, sometime I'll give a more detailed message on that, what each one specifically represents. Because some of you newer ones may not be familiar with even what the third tithe is, except in a general way. But I'll try to go into some detail of how that's done and why and what it's used for. But I just wanted to touch on that briefly before I get into the rest of this message, because there have been some questions come up with several of you concerning this in situations. So again, September 30th is the Feast of Trumpets. Day of Atonement is October 9th. Don't forget those days and keep them holy. And we generally on Trumpets have two services that day. On a Day of Atonement, since you're fasting, we generally just have one service. But those are holy days, and they're also days that God commands an offering, so don't forget that either. It's God's command. Okay, so again, this has an overview on those lessons 36 through 39 of the old correspondence course. Those are good overviews. Now, more than an overview, there's good detail in there for the upcoming fall holy days. Well, brother, I want to touch on a couple of things that have been in the news recently. I just haven't had time to get to these, so they're a little bit accumulated. But a couple of weeks ago, I know you're probably aware of this, that there was a military conflict, brief as it may be, between Russia and Georgia, the country of Georgia, not the state of Georgia where I live, but it's the country of Georgia in southern Russia. It was part of what was once part of the Warsaw Pact, or the old USSR. But, of course, the news media tries to portray that it's just pure Russian aggression as a result that caused this. But if you do some studying into it through good news sources on the internet, online newspapers, especially European ones and ones that try to stay out of politics, then you'll see that there was a lot more to it, that Russia was really provoked into this so-called invasion of Georgia. And really, when you find out who's behind it all, and I'll just sum it up in one sentence, it's the United States and Britain are really more or less provoked it. And you can study into that yourself and prove it one way or the other. But it all comes down to a couple of things that the United States has been trying to, since the dissolution of the USSR, since around 1990 at least, that the United States through NATO and its power there has been trying to encircle Russia and trying to heavily influence those what were once Warsaw Pact, or that what we used to call the buffer zone between Russia and Europe, Czechoslovakia, Poland, all those countries, and that includes Georgia and the Ukraine. As Mr. Armstrong used to say, always keep your eyes on the Balkans, the Balkans and Caucasus area, because they'll play a pivotal role in what will result in a World War III. And so we're beginning to see it heat up. And many have Many have thought since the dissolution or dissolving of the USSR, that now there's just Russia and this former satellite countries, many of or who now are claiming independence or have, many have thought that Russia is no longer a player in, on the world scene or in prophecy. But as I've stated before, if you go back and listen to some of these messages or sermons from Mr. Armstrong from the early 80s, and he shows where specifically Russia will play a part in pushing, or at least helping to bring about that not only the European unification, but the actual war that will break out. So they will have a part to play in it. Not that they will cause it, because there's other things that's going to cause it, which I'm going to touch on shortly. But so Russia is not out of it by any means. In fact, even though they supposedly have been not so much a world player or not on the scene for the last 15 years, oh yes they have. They've been very much on the scene. They're very active in any country that hates the United States and Britain, or what we consider enemies or hostile or terrorist countries. You'll find the Russia is very instrumental in behind the scenes working in those countries, either with military advisors or actually shipping in various technology and military arms to help build those countries up. So they haven't gone away by any means. They're very active still. So we shouldn't forget that. And read those old articles. And if you need a copy of one, I can mail it to you. It's Russia. There's one called Russia in Prophecy, and the other one was Will Russia Attack America, both by Mr. Armstrong. And they're very much still up to date. It just shows what the part that Gog and Magog will play in prophecy as time goes on. Well, so it does have a lot to do with a very large oil and natural gas pipeline that runs through Georgia down to the southwestern coast of that in the Black Sea, where much of the world's oil comes through that area. And so the United States is trying to secure its own self-interest in various parts of the world, and many times you'll see it revolves around oil, which ties into our economic situation, and what moves our economy really is oil through airplanes and trucks and, you know, all these 18-wheelers on the highways. Without those, our economy would literally shut down. But lately, you know, what we see dominating the news right now, at least here in the United States, unfortunately, is politics. You know, this upcoming presidential election is dominating the news, literally, and it's a shame because we're not able to see what's really going on behind the scenes. But fortunately, God's people know enough to, that there are many things going on behind the scenes, and you have to just dig for it and look for it, and you can find it a lot on the internet through some, at least the good news sources. There are a lot of crazy ones out there, but some of the more reputable news sources will show what's really going on behind the scenes. One of the things that's happened, and I've been more or less preaching on this off and on for a couple of years, is to keep an eye on our economy, because it's teetering on the brink of literal disaster. One of the things that happened just this past weekend, on the weekend of the 7th and 8th, or 6th and 7th of September here, 2008, is the actual government intervention and bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That's the two largest government-backed or government-sponsored lending institutions in the United States. And they are responsible to the tune of almost $5.5 to $6 trillion of debt and mortgage debt in investments for this country. So their stock had plummeted from I think one was a year or two ago $40-something, and the other one was $80-something a share. Now they're both just about worthless. And of course, a couple of months ago, I think the last time I addressed the economy, they had just begun to falter and hit the news about their horrible situation they're in. Well, it's taken the government this long, a couple of months or more, to finally take action and begin to bail them out. Now, what I've seen on some of these economic news channels and news pundits and economic experts and economists is that this is just nothing more than a Band-Aid, and they fear, many of them, I was just surprised to hear some of these comments from these economists, they fear that this is going to be a major backlash on our government and our economy, which will affect every single one of us. And the reason why is the government intervention of these two large institutions is really going to be bailed out and paid for by the American tax dollar, which means you and I and every other American who pays taxes. So it's just going to add to an already bad situation. Another thing to keep in mind, since the one economist said, in effect, what is happening with these two huge lending institutions, instead of being privatized like they had been, they now, or other banks and other institutions, they are now being nationalized. So when you begin to see the government intervene and nationalize private institutions, you're beginning to see a more of a socialist society, or maybe even worse than that. A couple of comments that were made by some of the economists were, and that they're afraid of, and we're already beginning to see people clamor about it, is that when you see the government bail out huge businesses like this, or any business, it's like a green light for all the other businesses that are in trouble. General Motors has been in bad trouble this year financially, and I mentioned previously, some months ago, that it was on the brink of bankruptcy. Well, they are already clamoring now, since they see this bailout of Freddie and Fannie from the government. They are already clamoring and holding their hands out, saying, well, we need to apply for the same thing. And so what we're about to see is a snowball effect of many huge companies that are in trouble, and other banking institutions, for that matter, and other corporations who are in financial trouble, will all be lining up with the government, saying, look, you bailed out Fannie and Freddie, why not us? You know, don't discriminate. So this could cause a whole other problem there with just a tax burden that's just, you can't even begin to imagine. So that's just one aspect. I mean, the credit crunch is still going on. The housing debacle is still going on. Housing is still on a decline. And there's still some 2 million more between now and the first part of middle of 2009, this next year from now. There's still over 2 million more housing loans that are going to be going into the ARMs, adjusted rate mortgages. They're going to be going into those balloon payments. In other words, there's going to be roughly 2 million, maybe even more, foreclosures added to the couple of million that we've already had this past year. So it's just going to continue to get worse in the housing sector. So with that little bit of information, that's just a couple of points of overview there, because I've discussed it before, and hopefully all of you all are watching the economy and studying into it, or keeping an eye on it anyway, because the government is frantically trying to throw Band-Aids and patch all these leaks in this economic bubble that's about to explode and burst. They see the leaks beginning to open up in some areas worse than others, so they're frantically trying to put Band-Aids over all of this. You know, our national debt is almost at $10 trillion. You know, the Freddie and Fannie deal, you know, they're responsible with $5 trillion of U.S. debt, maybe close to $5.5 trillion. But our national debt that's on the books is roughly $10 trillion. But the total debt, I was listening to this several times in the last few days, the total U.S. debt, national and personal and individual, corporate, all of it added together, they estimate to be $57 trillion. Now, that's just mind-boggling when you think about it. So there's no way that these Band-Aids are going to help. We're on our way down. So, you know, with that little bit of knowledge, I want to go back to and read something that I've read before from Mr. Armstrong about this and how it ties into the European Union. Because already, I don't know how many of you have noticed this or read it online, and like on the EU Observer or other websites, but there's already quite a few European countries that are in a deep recession, and they tie that recession right back directly into what's happening in the United States. And that has a lot to do with the fact that the U.S. dollar is still the leading currency in the world, or the so-called standard for other currencies. But that's going to change very soon. And one of the things that's a player in all this is actually foreign investment in foreign countries, because, for example, China and Russia and many of the European countries, in Japan and Germany, they're all buying U.S. dollars right now to try to help prop up the not only the U.S. economy, but they're also to stabilize their own economic recessions and to prevent higher inflation and to slow their recessions down. So they're temporarily, because I had wondered, why has the price of oil been dropping lately? There's been no apparent reason for it. The government has not made any announcements. This is exactly verbatim what some of the economists have been saying recently. They finally dawned on them why the price of oil has been coming down. There's two main reasons, and it should be going up. And one of the reasons is people are slowing down a bit on their driving because of the price of gas. But there's a lot more to it than that. And the reason why is much of the world's oil, that is bought and paid for with U.S. dollars. Not all of it, but much. And that's also changing because people are switching to euros or even their own currencies, which is helping to bring the dollar down more. But so many of these countries that I just mentioned are buying U.S. dollars to help temporarily prop up the U.S. economy, not so much to help us, but to help themselves, because they realize there's a trickle-down effect. You know, we truly do have a world economy now, and what happens to one country, especially a huge country like ours, will affect many other countries, and that's what's been happening. So that many European countries are experiencing economic recession right now, and they directly tie it and see that it's caused by what's happening in the United States, all of these financial problems we have. And so, yes, they're beginning to get a little more aggravated. The ECB, European Central Bank, has been doing some brainstorming, trying to figure out how to prevent this from happening again. In other words, they're trying to figure out a way to cut the economic tie. They want to be economically independent, and so they want to loosen their ties with the West or the United States. And they are beginning to do that, and they're going to do it more and more, and at some point they're going to do it completely. When they suddenly realize, and I think they already do, they just got to learn how to deal with it, that the European economy is already now far larger than what the United States is. Their gross national product or gross domestic product, their net worth, their actual funds on hand, they're just much more economically stable than the United States is now, and other countries are beginning to realize that, so they're bailing out of the U.S. dollar and buying euros. But at some point, it's going to be a very sudden thing when they finish or complete it, and the United States is going to find itself very isolated initially economically, and then also eventually militarily. And it all ties together. So I want to read something that I've read before from Mr. Armstrong, and then I'm going to play an excerpt from a sermon that he did a year later that I listened to last Sabbath, and it had a very interesting statement in there that ties back into this letter, or this what I'm about to read, and he does show exactly what's going to happen to cause the sudden unification of Europe and all these things springing together suddenly. So if you have I have a hardback edition here of the autobiography of Mr. Armstrong, Volume 2, and I'll be reading from page 626, and these are co-worker letters, and if you've got co-worker letters, it's the one from July 24th, 1983. Remember that, 1983. He says, "Dear brethren and co-workers with Christ, a staggering turn in world events may occur suddenly at any day from now on. God has been holding back these world-shaking events." Now, pause from reading, because we know now why God was holding back those events. Mr. Armstrong, I don't know that he knew why, or maybe he did and just didn't tell us, but he does go on to say in this letter that he can tell you why he knows God has held back the events, but not necessarily why he held them back. Well, we should look back now and see that we had to go into a time of testing and trial to follow that command of Jesus Christ that he gave to the end of the Philadelphia era to see who would hold fast. And of course we see the result of that. Anyway, let me continue reading. "A staggering turn in world events may occur suddenly at any day from now on. God has been holding back these world-shaking events, but now they may strike suddenly while the world least expects it." See, don't forget that, brother. This is still up to date. "Strike suddenly while the world least expects it. The very first issue of the Plain Truth magazine appeared in February 1934, just 50 years ago, lacking about 6 months. The article, starting on the cover page, warned of a coming sudden appearance of a resurrected Holy Roman Empire in Europe, a union of 10 nations in Europe under one government, with one united military force. For 50 years, I've been crying out to the world the Bible prophecies of this coming United States of Europe, a new united superpower, perhaps more powerful than either the Soviet Union or the United States. Well, now we know they will be. They already are economically. Continue reading. No one believes me now. Pause some reading. Well, there's still many people that don't believe Mr. Armstrong, including a vast majority of God's own people that don't believe what God revealed through that man. He said, no one believed me then, but since then, the European common market has appeared, with 10 nations cooperating commercially in a tariff-free common market. Now, I'm going to skip a page here to go page 628 and get to the crux of it. And on the last paragraph of page 628, Mr. Armstrong says, in my private meeting with him, Dr. Habsburg, that was Dr. Otto von Habsburg, expressed disappointment that progress on the European unification had moved so slowly. I expressed the conviction, see, Mr. Armstrong was convicted, that some totally unexpected, world-shocking event could occur suddenly at any time that would high pressure European nations to gather overnight, adopting the Constitution already prepared by the European Parliament. Pause from reading. Well, Mr. Armstrong had that conviction now that something would happen. He wasn't sure what it was at that time. This was in 1983. He just knew something was going to happen to cause this to happen pretty much overnight, suddenly, snap together. Well, what I'm about to play you when I finish reading this is a part of a sermon that he did 1 year later, right about almost a year later. Yes, actually, it was just about, you see the date on this letter, July? Yeah, this soundbite that I'm going to play was from July 84, exactly 1 year later. And he says that he believes he saw what that one thing would be to cause it, and I'll touch on, we'll play that shortly. Let me finish reading. It's interesting, he says here, adopting the Constitution already prepared. See, they've had a Constitution prepared for a long time, but they've had problems ratifying it, and they've had to rewrite it many times, and they have another ratification process coming up later this year, hopefully we'll have, their hope is to have it all signed into effect and finally done in early part of 2009. Let me continue reading. He says that this Parliament, although without substantial power, is composed of leaders who are framing the Constitution in advance. He mentioned that there are madmen such as Gaddafi or Khomeini who could pull off some startling unexpected international act that would press the panic button in Europe. Pause from reading. Well, that's true. That could happen. That's one of the things that could happen. There could be several things that happen simultaneously because the world troubles are increasing in all aspects of society. But he does go on to show something more specific. He says, Mr. Armstrong says, incidentally, Doctors Habsburg and Strauss are close friends, and for some reason I do not understand, but maybe of God's designing, both are very friendly to me and to Ambassador College. Mr. Armstrong says, now, let me tell you why I know God has held back the end-time world events and why he will cause things to snap together suddenly when least expected and bring this world suddenly to its end. In the coming of Christ in supreme power and glory to rule all nations, ushering in the kingdom of God and the world tomorrow. He says in Matthew 24, verses 32 through 35, Jesus said that when we see world events now occurring, we are to know that the end is very near within this generation. Yet of the day and the hour, verse 36, we cannot know. Yet when it strikes, it will strike suddenly, unexpectedly, like a trap that springs shut on a hapless rat without warning. Get that, brethren, without warning. If one knew at what hour a thief would come in the night to burglarize his house, he would have watched and been ready to resist him. We have been seeing these end-time world events coming for several years now. God has delayed or held up world events. See, Mr. Armstrong knew it was being held up. He knew he was ahead of his time. He always was. But listen, he says, God has delayed or held up world events. Yet, he will suddenly cut his work short and end things as unexpectedly and suddenly as when the trap springs on a rat before he can move. Pause from reading. Well, he puts a lot of emphasis in this letter about things happening suddenly unexpectedly and without warning. He uses those words over and over. In other words, he's trying to instill urgency in us. He was always urgent. Finally, just one more paragraph here, because it does apply, it did apply to him, but it also applies to us. He says, when Europe suddenly unites, our work, which Christ is doing with and through us, will quickly be over, and Christ coming very soon thereafter. Well, that's true still today. The work that Christ is doing through us, brethren, will suddenly stop when that European Union comes together, and by the grace of God and His love, will be taken to a place of protection. So that's all I'm going to read from there. And at this point, I do want to try to see if I can get this to record, this short sound bite. It's about a minute and 30 seconds. And it ties right into what I just read. And Mr. Armstrong will show you and me what exactly will cause this unification of Europe.
And I can see now the event that is going to trigger the formation of reunification in Europe, the resurrection of the medieval Holy Roman Empire that we've been looking forward to, that has prophesied to come. Something has been holding it back. And a year ago, when Dr. Otto von Hotzenberg was here, he'd come over here to see me on July the 10th last year, just about a year ago. He couldn't understand why they aren't able to get this unification through sooner. Something is causing it to lag and to hold it up. I said to him, I've been wondering about the same thing. But I believe that some event is going to happen suddenly, just like out of a blue sky, that is going to shock the whole world and is going to cause the nations of Europe to realize they must unite. Well, he said he believed that would have to happen too. Well, now I think I can see what may be the very event that is going to trigger it, and that is the economic situation in the world.
Okay, so we should be able to see now, as Mr. Armstrong said, it's economic conditions in the world, and many of those economic conditions in the world tie directly in to the United States and how we've squandered our wealth, as I've mentioned many times, and Mr. Armstrong has in his writings. We've squandered our wealth and become, in the last 15 or 20 years, we went from the largest creditor nation to the largest debtor nation in the world, owing the largest debt of any country and more than the history of any country that there ever has been. It's a shame, but we have fallen into a trap. It has to do with our own national sins. This ties into something that just came to mind. I turned to Leviticus 26. I've covered this here before, but this is part of what we're about to reap. Leviticus 26 and verse 14, God says, but if you do not, this is the blessings and cursings, and this is the beginning of the cursings, but if you do not obey me, verse 14, and do not observe all these commandments, and if you despise my statutes, or if your soul abhors my judgments, so that you do not perform all my commandments, but break my covenant, I also will do this to you. I will even appoint terror over you, wasting disease, a fever which shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart, and you shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. And that, those two words there, which says you shall sow your seed in vain, the translation of in vain, it means without profit. If you have a margin, it'll tell you that. So you shall sow your seed without profit, for your enemies shall eat it. I will set, verse 17, I will set my face against you, and you shall be defeated by your enemies. Those who hate you shall reign over you, and you shall flee when no one pursues you. And it goes on to show how God increases his punishment seven times in intensity, over and over, as a result of not repenting, and as a result of our national sins. So I want to read briefly, since this does tie into economics. I'm going to read briefly from I've read a little bit of it a while back, but I want to read a good part of this article that Mr. Armstrong wrote in the Good News. It was a personal in the Good News, February of 1971, because here we are, brethren, going in, and friends, going into some tough economic times, and some of you already are in tough economic times, and but God has given us a guideline on how to avoid that, and it does have to do with tithing and being responsible with your own income and with God's part of your income. See, it's not your tithes or my tithes, it's God's. And I want to reiterate some things that Mr. Armstrong says in this article. For on behalf of our prospective members, but also for all of us as a reminder, because we are about to enter some tough economic times, and God promises a way to remain stable during that time. He never promises to make us rich or wealthy. So that's something you have to understand. See, God, tithing is one of those laws that is a test. Let me just hear something else came to mind. Let me just turn to Malachi. And I know we've covered this before, but it's just one little tiny thing I want to point out. Malachi verse 3, beginning in verse 8, it says, "Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me, but you say, in what way have we robbed you? In tithes and offerings, God says. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation." Now listen to this, verse 10. This is what I want to point out. "Bring all the tithes into the storehouse." See, that's where they go. They go to God's house, where God's work is, "that there may be food in my house." And listen what he says. "Try me now in this." See, that's one of the laws, very few, that you will hear God say, "Try me on." Of course, the Sabbath is a test commandment also, but it also is a commandment that is a sign of God's people. But this law of tithing, God says in verse 10, "Try me now." In other words, test me, says the Eternal, "if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it." Now, that doesn't necessarily mean financial, although it does, financial, but also physical or spiritual blessings, all of it, all those blessings. And of course, the spiritual blessings are the things we should be most appreciative of, because we cannot put a price on that. Understanding that we'll inherit all things with Jesus Christ, and that being that wonderful family of God, and all those wonderful truths and that knowledge He's revealed to us. But here God is promising to bless you and I if we bring those tithes into His house. So He says, try me on this. So we have to remember that it is a test commandment, but it's also a commandment that we have to keep. We don't have a choice. God, this is for all mankind, especially for the household of God, members of God's church, and it is for all mankind. They just aren't aware of it yet, just like the other laws and commandments of God in keeping of His holy days. So I want to touch on this in this article. It is, again, from the personal, from the February 71 Good News. Mr. Armstrong says, "Some of our readers of tomorrow's world are unemployed right now. Others may be in danger of losing their jobs." We'll pause some reading. See, some of us are in danger of losing our jobs. And I don't think any of us are wealthy by any means. But yet, if you look around, even some of the poorest in this country are still far wealthier than many of the third world countries. And with all the poverty and anguish and squalor that's going on in the world, our standard of living is still higher than all others, although that's going to be changing, and it already is beginning to change with many people. Others may be in danger of losing their jobs. "Not since the closing of the Great Depression have so many been without jobs." Well, that still applies today, and it's getting worse by the day. He says, yet as a recent article in the Plain Truth pointed out, in 1969, there was an average of 3 million hirings every month in the United States, although in 1970, that rate dropped somewhat. Estimates indicate businessmen and employers are even now hiring many thousands every month. Someone must replace those who retire, quit, die, or are fired. Of course, new jobs constantly open as businesses expand, communities grow, buildings are built, and people buy more goods. Pause from reading. Well, that's beginning to slow down. The business expansion and growth of new communities and buildings, like you just mentioned, are beginning to slow down. So we are going into a time that's unprecedented, I believe, in our economy. He continues, "Who will obtain these jobs depends on certain basic unseen laws. There are certain economic laws that regulate economic conditions. I remember vividly the sudden nosedive depression of 1920. I was then a publisher's representative in Chicago. I was a member of the Chicago Association of Commerce through its advertising club division. In early January that year, at the regular midweek Association of Commerce luncheon in the cameo room of the Morrison Hotel, the noted business analyst Roger Babson was the speaker. He warned the businessmen of Chicago that within less than a year we were going to crash into the most drastic economic depression our generation had seen. Pause from reading. Well, this is very interesting because I mentioned before where this is quoted in Mystery of the Ages and other writings of Mr. Armstrong, but in some of my recent research on some economic websites like Financial Times and Republic Trading, that they post daily articles from around the United States, things that are going on behind the scenes in the economy. It's interesting that quite a few of them are beginning to go back to Roger Babson. You know, he's it's interesting that they're beginning to see things that he warned of, and they're applying it to now. They're using that Roger Babson type analysis, but there's not many. You have to really search for it, search for these particular articles and reports, but many of them are beginning to go, a few are anyway, to back to that Roger Babson outlook of dangers and warning signs of impending danger in the economy. So I just thought that was interesting. I'll continue reading. He said, I noticed some important bankers and security brokers smile. He's still quoting Mr. Babson. No, I'm sorry, this is Mr. Armstrong. He says, I noticed some important bankers and security brokers smile knowingly in disagreement. They were sure Mr. Babson was wrong. A year later, Mr. Babson was again the speaker at the same association. He says, Mr. Babson, I saw some of you businessmen smile a year ago when I warned you of the coming economic tragedy, he said. Now let me tell you why I knew that was coming, and you didn't. When you want to know what is the temperature in the room, now you look at the thermometer on the wall. But if you want to know what the temperature will be in an hour or two from now, the thermometer can't tell you. So you go down to the boiler room or consult the United States Weather Prophet. You look at the factors that determine conditions, not the thermometer that records conditions after they have occurred. You gentlemen look at charts of current business activity, at bank clearings, records of freight car loadings, the stock market quotations, the thermometer's on the wall. But, he continued, there are laws that govern economic conditions. These laws are the factors which determine what conditions will be a few months or a year from now. They are the causes. Now, the subtitle here is How Your Future is Determined. Mr. Armstrong says, yes, and your own personal. Now, listen to this, friends and brethren, because this is going to affect every single one of us in the months ahead. Yes, and your own personal economic future is determined by definite laws. See, L-A-W-S. Very few realize that the eternal Creator set in motion invisible yet inexorable laws which regulate personal financial conditions. In my 40 years in God's ministry, I have seen these laws actively work in the experiences of many people whom I have known personally. I have experienced the relentless working in my own life. I had to learn this lesson the hard way myself. Pause some reading. Well, I can say that. I've had to learn these lessons the hard way myself because I'm a hard-headed Israelite, and I had to learn these many years ago, and some of you are learning them right now. Continue reading. I have often mentioned on the air and in articles in The Plain Truth how God struck me down, not physically, but economically, to bring me to Him. That very depression of 1920 destroyed my business, in which I was making the equivalent of $35,000 a year in today's money. Well, that was $35,000 equivalent to 1971. See, today that would be far more than that. He says, everything I touched turned not to gold like King Midas, but to loss of and lack of money. It was in poverty and hunger that God actually conquered me and turned me to Him, giving my life to Him over 40 years ago. But even after conversion, even after my ordination as a minister of Christ and Jesus Christ in 1931, our family was still on the economic rocks. Now, I'll pause from reading, because in the autobiography, Mr. Armstrong, when you read that section of his life, him and his wife, Mrs. Loma Armstrong, they spent 28 long years in poverty. 28. This is after his conversion. They spent 28 long years in poverty as he was learning all these truths that came gradually over time before God began to bless him economically. So they spent a long time, 28 years in absolute poverty before God began to bless them. So there are people that are disgruntled, former members, that think that Mr. Armstrong was always wealthy and a money hog and all this, but that's not true. If you read the autobiography, you'll see a very clear story of how a man and his wife learned to live by faith, and I mean literally by faith. And that's what it's going to come down to us, brethren, before it's all over. Again, I'll repeat, he says, but even after conversion, even after my ordination as a minister of Jesus Christ, 1931, our family was still on the economic rocks. I had begun to learn something about God's law of tithing as a Bible doctrine. I had studied it in the Bible. I had learned, seen proved, that this law was still in effect. Yet in those early years, it didn't seem to apply to me. I had seen it as a doctrine to accept as true, not as a law which I personally must obey. How many of you are right now like I was then? Good question, see? Good question for all of us to ponder. And that's something that when you learn it the hard way, that's the easiest way for me to stay on track in that area of my life, is to realize it's not an option. It's a law of God. And once you realize it is a law, then it's like all the other laws. They all tie in together, that spiritual law. And then it's easier to have the right focus and perspective on it. He says, how many of you right now are like I was then? For a few months, I had been receiving a salary of $20 per week as a minister, holding evangelistic campaigns. We had been able to live very modestly on that, but at the end of November that year, the salary was cut off. The church conference treasury was empty. I had learned the lesson of faith. I trusted God implicitly to supply every need, as he has promised. Philippians 4, verse 9. He says, but I didn't realize how much we must try the spirits, whether they are of God. And this is something we have to keep in mind, brethren, too. Let's listen to this lesson. He says, I didn't realize yet how much we must try the spirits that they are of God. That's 1 John 4:1. So when a former newspaper associate came to me with an urgent request that I join him as advertising manager of a new morning newspaper he was starting, I assumed foolishly and without making sure this offer was caused by God, that it was the answer to my petition to supply our financial need. I had not yet learned, as I was to learn later, how to launch out in God's work on faith, knowing that God had called me. Of course, many trials to launch themselves. Let me try this again. Of course, many, many people, in other words, many tried to launch themselves into God's ministry when God never called them. They are making a bigger mistake than I made in turning back to the advertising profession. In my case, God had called me from the advertising profession into his work. He had ordained me, put me into his ministry. I had put my hand to the plow, but did not realize Jesus' command to never turn back. Of course, I did not turn back from the Christian life, nor for that matter even consider for a minute that I was turning back from the ministry. I regarded this only as a temporary job. I thought God had sent it to supply this need temporarily. I actually accepted the job on the condition that it was to last 3 weeks only, fully expecting the way would open back to me to be in the ministry within 3 weeks. But once on this newspaper job, there was no quitting. God did not open the way to get back into his ministry until a year and 3 months had passed, during which time I had realized my mistake and prayed earnestly to be released from the newspaper job and restored to God's work. God let me learn the lesson by experience, that his instruction to ministers, preach the word, be instant in season and out of season, meant keep at it in season and out of season. Next subtitle, how I learned a lesson. Once this is the part we need to pay attention to, because we have to realize that not everything is necessarily an open door, or not necessarily everything is from God, or caused by God, or even caused by Satan. See, brethren, sometimes it's our own human nature. Anyway, he says, how I learned a lesson. Once on this newspaper job, in December 1931, in the midst of the Great Depression, there was no money to pay salaries. I had to work out a way of trading advertising for food, clothing, and hotel and rooming house accommodations for the 23 men on the staff. We had frequently gone hungry before I was converted. Now we went hungry even more frequently. Then one day, see, this is after he was converted, then one day it dawned on my mind that we ourselves were actually breaking God's financial law by not tithing. All of a sudden, God made me see his financial law as something personal, not merely a doctrine to accept impersonally. It meant me. That very day I took 10% of what we had, and it was not enough to buy food, and added an offering and mailed it to the church treasury. That very afternoon, food came for a completely adequate meal. I don't remember how, but I do remember that the very day I repented for not having to accept, for not having accepted tithing as a personal obligation instead of a mere doctrinal argument, that very day food came. God did not bring us immediate financial prosperity. See, God did not bring us immediate financial prosperity for some years more for our own good. We were forced to live in very poor economic circumstances, but that very day our financial conditions started upward. So pause from reading. We have to realize that too, brethren. It is a test from God. He says, try me, and he will bless us, but he doesn't always say how soon or how fast. Sometimes we have to learn some hard lessons if we've gotten ourselves into it and knowingly violated God's laws. So we have to pay that penalty, but God will. Once we repent and turn the other way, God will begin the transition of bringing you out of it. It may not happen instantly. In some cases, it may. He knows what your needs are, but it's like what I've experienced over the years and learned from tithing, that God does bless, and it's just a miracle every day. He doesn't promise necessarily to financially bless you. Yes, but yet he does. He just doesn't say how and what way. But he always will take care of your needs. That's the point that I'm getting to. He always will provide for your needs. And that's part of those blessings that he says he will open in Malachi 3 verse 10. He says, I'll pour out for you such a blessing that will not be room enough to receive it. So he'll compensate for your needs financially and physically and spiritually, whatever you need. The next subtitle, he scores of friends too. Since that time, Mr. Armstrong says, I have known of the experience of scores of other people. It was only a short time after that experience that God opened the way to bring me back into his active ministry. By this time, I had learned that lesson too. I have never left God's service and never shall, as long as God permits me to live. It was some months later that the very man whom God sent with his truck to move us, together with what household furniture we had, back to the Willamette Valley in Oregon, where I was to start an evangelistic campaign in Salem, himself had an experience in tithing. This young man already was tithing the money that he handled. He was a farmer and suddenly realized that they were not selling their eggs. He had not been tithing them in any way. He brought us a tithe of all the eggs his hens had laid that day. Believe it or not, that same day his hens went on an egg-laying spree. Yes, laugh if you will, but those hens cackled too. It actually happened. It was the off-season for laying eggs, but that very day they began to lay more eggs than was normal in the best egg-laying season. It seemed incredible, but it happened. I have given you the facts before of the well driller who was unable to get any business. Now I have an article, pause from here, about this well driller, and it's hard. I have a hard copy of it. I don't have it in a digital file. It's a two-page article that I'll be glad to send to any of you that request it. I'll just have to do it. I'll have to scan it and send it as an email attachment. But it is a two-page article by Mr. Armstrong, written in 1973, entitled The Man Who Couldn't Afford to Tithe. And it is about this experience of this, it's about a page and a half. It's the detailed experience about this well driller that he's about to mention here. And his excuse of not being able to afford to tithe. But once he realized that he did begin tithing, God poured out all kinds of work on him. And he actually wound up having to hire people to help him. So he became, actually, later on, he became a baptized member of God's church. But he began to tithe once he realized that's what he should do. But he thought at first he couldn't afford to. Okay, here's where he's picked back up in this letter. Mr. Armstrong says, I have given you the facts before of the well driller who was unable to get any business in 1933. He began to tithe one single dollar of the only $10 he had. The next day, a man who had owed him $50 he never expected to collect came and paid it, and he tithed $5. Immediately, he began to get more wells to drill than he could handle. Almost daily, some radio listener of The World Tomorrow or co-workers in this great work writes me a letter telling me of a similar experience, beginning to pay God's honest tithe and beginning to prosper financially. And see, let me interject something here, pause from reading. This doesn't just apply to baptized members of God's church. It's anyone who becomes aware of that law of tithing and begins to keep it, repents and begins to keep it. So for those that are have questions about this, that are not yet baptized, that are prospective members, well, yes, God requires us as soon as we understand that tithing law. He requires that for the first tithe and second tithe. Now, continue reading. Mr. Armstrong says, now don't get the idea from this that in every case God is going to work some incredible miracle. See, don't get the idea that if you try, see, quote unquote, try tithing, it's not something you want to try, it's something you want to do. Don't get the idea that if you want to try tithing, you are to expect something, some astounding thing to happen, or that you are going to fall heir to $1 million the next day. Perhaps in most cases, the increase in income is not immediately apparent at all. But of this, you may be sure. Over the long haul, the 90% of income that God allows you to keep for yourself will increase to more than the 100% formerly was. God promises to bless and prosper the tither. He keeps his promises. There's a reason. God did not establish a binding law of tithing. Now listen to this. God did not establish a binding law of tithing without a good reason. Actually, there are many reasons. All of God's laws are for our good. Listen to God's word to us. He quotes here, he says, observe and hear all these words which I command you this day, that it may go well with you and your children after you forever. It's Deuteronomy 12, verse 28. Mr. Armstrong said, it is not good for a person to get something for nothing or for very little effort. This evil human urge to get without giving, to receive without paying, is the very thing in human nature that the very thing in human nature that produces criminals. See, that get attitude. All God's spiritual law may be summed up in one word, love, L-O-V-E. But Jesus magnified this into two great laws, to love God and love to human neighbor. Love is the principle of giving. Jesus summed up the reason for it when he said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. God knows and reveals what we receive is a greater blessing by giving than by acquiring. God wants us to have blessings. See, he does, brethren. People really want blessings, but few know the way. See, very few know the way to those blessings. Most people think the greater blessing comes from receiving or getting, taking or acquiring. Today we talk about the American way, but the way of most Americans today is to try to get more than they give. Pause from reading. This is exactly why this economy in this country is going to come down, friends and brethren, that I've been warning of. And it's tied into this economic situation. It really is. It's tied into the economy and this society and the United States and Britain, and why that it's tied in when it collapses. And as it collapses, the Europeans are being pressured into take more action to be more self-sufficient. And they're beginning to realize that their economy is larger than all of the United States and Britain together. And indeed, when that beast rises up, then you begin to see those prophecies that they're going to economically dominate the world. And it can happen any day. He continued reading. He says, formerly employers who took more in production from labor than they paid employees in wages. So labor organized. Today, the labor union principle seems to be get more in wages than they give in production from their labor. Less work, more pay. Diluted labor unions, see, they're diluted. Diluted labor unions seem to think this is for their good. They don't know God's law. They know not that they are bringing a curse on themselves. So you want to know the truth about labor unions, there you have it. Continue reading. We talk today about owning property, but God actually owns all the earth. That includes the property in which you pay taxes. God says the earth is his, for he created it. God owns it. He lets us occupy his earth as temporary tenants. Listen to this. I've mentioned this before. All wealth comes from the ground. See, that's where our national wealth, all the wealth from the world comes from initially, is from the ground. It may take different forms as it comes out of that ground. That's where it all comes down to. All wealth comes from the ground, he says. It is not good for man to take all he consumes out of God's earth without paying anything for it. If you rent ground from a man who thinks he owns it, he charges you rent up to 50% or more of what you produce from it. God set a law in motion that we should pay him not 50%, but only 10%, plus whatever offering we have in our hearts to give. Now, a law is not a law without a penalty. God does not force you to tithe. See, he doesn't force you to tithe. But if you don't, there is a penalty. You lose the blessing that goes with honest stewardship. You come under a curse. That's what happens if we don't tithe. Or if we misuse our tithes, for that matter. Continue reading. He says, God says, our whole nation is under a curse today. Malachi 3, verse 9. Because we have robbed God. The man who does not pay God his tithe is a thief. And worse than a criminal robbing a bank. He is robbing God. Think about that. Robbing God is far worse than robbing an institution on this earth. He continues, yes, God says so. Malachi 3, verse 8. And one of the Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not steal. The man who does put himself immediately under the law, under the penalty of death for all eternity, unless he repents and pleads the blood of Christ for forgiveness and reconciliation to God. Ignorance of the law does not excuse. Ignorance, see, this applies to everyone. Ignorance of the law does not excuse. You may say, well, I never knew all this. Well, you are without excuse, for you know it now, or you can know it if you'll check up in your own Bible. But God is most merciful. The minute you really repent, quit breaking this law, begin keeping it honestly, and go to Christ for forgiveness, then all is forgiven, and God begins pouring out his blessing, just as he did on me. Hundreds of our co-workers have written me during the past many years saying God had opened their eyes to his tithing law and telling how they have been blessed. One even wrote that she, too, had started tithing eggs, and her hens, too, had immediately gone into an egg-laying spree. She had either heard me mention that experience over the air or read it in a former issue of The Plain Truth. Of course, I won't guarantee God will cause hens to start laying eggs faster every time. Probably it won't work out exactly that way, but he does promise a blessing. Malachi 3, verse 10 and 12, which I read previously. That's the end of reading from this article. Well, excuse me, actually, there's actually one more little sentence I want to read under the next subtitle. Mr. Armstrong says, how do you pay your tithes to God? By putting them into God's work where God himself is working. A pause from reading. Well, that still applies today. Will you discern where God is working? That's where your tithes go. It's very simple. So, that concludes reading from there. I was just looking over this article. I'm going to go ahead and read a little bit this two-page article, The Man Who Couldn't Afford to Tithe. I am going to read from the a paragraph from the last page of it because it's important, because it applies to majority of us. And it's the subtitle, Tithing While in Debt. Tithing While in Debt. Mr. Armstrong says, yet so many say, quote, I don't think it would be right for me to tithe while I'm in debt, unquote. Mr. Armstrong says, yes, it is right, and the other way is wrong. There's a way which seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death, Proverbs 14. God's word tells us what is right, and God tells us to pay his work the first fruits of all of our income, Proverbs 3, verse 9 and 10. Regarding our material and financial needs, even debt, God says, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. See, that's Matthew 6, 33. All those things that you need, see. The tithe is, he says, the tithing is the debt that you and I owe God. This debt is first in time and principle. Pay your debts to God, make him your partner in your finances, and receive his blessing in temporary affairs. This will enable you to pay your debts. See, this will enable you to pay your debts or to get a job or to have your needs supplied more quickly than if you evaded his debt. Remember, you're all, see, and me too, our all, brethren, belongs to him, not to us, or you, not to you or me. That's Deuteronomy 10, verse 14. You and I are in the position of steward handling that which belongs to another. He is your silent partner. And the first tenth, in addition to offerings, is his share. The rest he gives freely to you. But if you appropriate for yourself his share, you are stealing and robbing God, Malachi 3:8. Would you pay your debts with money to another man had left in your trust? If a man working in a bank does that, we call it embezzlement. Think about that. The only sure way to know you have God as a partner and that he is taking care of your interests is to obey him in tithing. When God receives his portion of all your income, God becomes your partner, sharing in your profits. He causes his partners to prosper, See, there's a scripture in the New Testament that says, I wish above all, brethren, that you be in good health and prosper. See, God wants us to prosper. He causes his partners to prosper. So if you are in debt, take God into partnership first and watch him prosper you until finally you are out of debt. Remember, the debt you owe God comes first. That's a good thing to remember. That's something I had to learn a long time, too. And once I got it into my thick skull, that, you know, out of my paycheck, the gross of it, not the net, is what the tithe is, out of the gross. And before I pay anything else, the tithes go first, that first tenth. See, at first, and then, of course, the second tithe goes into your account for the feet, for the holy days and feast. So, but when you put God first, and then and what you have left out of, then worry about your bills, and it's going to work out. It will always work out. And one thing tithing will teach you to do, too, if you're not familiar with it, it will teach you how to budget your household income. It most certainly will. See, most of the people in the world don't have to worry about this. They have more expendable income because they don't tithe. But those who do tithe learn to budget and to do more with less, because we have to budget our household income. We do it right now, my wife and I, with our family. And we have a family of five. And we're probably what you would call lower middle income bracket. So, yeah, we have to budget pretty tightly on our household income. But it's done after tithing, not before. Anyway, I wanted to just touch on these things because they all tie together. What's going on in the news, what's going on in the economy, that profound statement that Mr. Armstrong made in his autobiography, and then what he did a year later in a sermon showing that it is the economic conditions that's going to cause all this to happen. So, it was just a year later after he had written that coworker letter, God revealed to him more clearly what was going to be the underlying cause of the unification of the European Union. So the good news about that is when we see that happen, we're on a very, very short time, very short time. And we can see the beginnings of it now. So that should be exciting to us. So I hope this has been helpful. Again, as you approach the Feast of Trumpets, please review that lesson. I could almost give a sermon on each one of these holy days before then if I have time. I'm still trying to do a lot of preparation for the feast. But that lesson 36... for the Feast of Trumpets, lesson 37 for Atonement, 38 for the Feast of Tabernacles, and 39 for the Last Great Day. So this will be a great study between now and the Feast of Tabernacles, or between now and Atonement in Trumpets, to get you, especially prospective members, to get you more grounded in the purpose and the meaning of God's holy days. So I hope this has been helpful, and hopefully I'll be able to talk to you again in the next few days. There's another topic or two I'd like to address between now and the feast, and God willing, I'll have time to get that done too. And so until then, do take care. I love you all.